name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website. And I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 174. I'm recording it on Friday, October 2nd, 2009. The PE10 level today is 19. That's on the high side. The long-term value proposition of stocks is better than it was before the crash, but dubious for the long-term rational investor. The title of the musical selection is Dopey Elephant. The title of the podcast is Deferred Market Efficiency. What it is, what it signifies. There was a question posed to me some time ago, several months ago now, by Frank Curmudgeon, that's a screen name, the owner of the Bad Money Advice blog. And it's been on my mind for a long time, and I feel now I've discussed it in earlier podcasts because it's been bothering me. And I gave some partial responses to Frank, but none that totally satisfied me. But I now feel I've gotten a better grasp of it. Sometimes these things take time. You have to sort of play with different ideas. And the question was, a solid question, the valuation-informed indexing strategy, the rational investing model, is rooted in a premise. That premise is that valuations affect long-term returns. If valuations affect long-term returns, the idea of staying at the same stock allocation at all valuation levels makes precisely zero sense. So rational investing is a rejection of passive investing. It's an alternate model. But there are points of agreement between the two models, and one of the points of agreement is that short-term timing does not work, that it's not possible to predict where the market is going to go in the next week or the next month or the next year or the next 2 years. Where we part company is, passive investors say that long-term timing does not work, that no form of timing works. Rational investors say long-term timing always works, that all long-term timing is, long-term timing is changing your stock allocation with the understanding that you should be keeping it with the aim of keeping your risk profile roughly constant. So when stocks go to insanely high prices, you're not going to be at the same stock allocation that you were at when stocks were at reasonable prices. You're going to adjust your stock allocation so that you're taking on roughly the same amount of risk. And if a 70% stock allocation was right for you at a time of moderate valuation, perhaps 20% is right at a time of insanely high prices, like those we saw from 1996 through 2008. So valuation-informed indexing is a strategy where you adjust your stock allocation to keep your risk profile roughly constant, and the historical data shows that if you do this throughout your investing lifetime, you will earn higher returns, significantly higher returns, at significantly less risk, and thereby make it possible for you to retire 5 years sooner than if you had followed the passive indexing strategy or the passive investing model. I argued for this. So I did a guest blog entry at the Money and Such blog saying why long-term timing works even though short-term timing doesn't, because this is, of course, the key misunderstanding, the key fallacy of passive investing. They pound and pound and pound this idea that timing doesn't work, timing doesn't work, timing doesn't work. And if you ask them why they believe that, they point to these studies, and there are hundreds of them, thousands, I guess, showing that short-term timing doesn't work. And you say, "Well, thanks a lot for the link, but I agree with you. We have no dispute on this point. Do you have any studies that show long-term timing doesn't work? Has there ever been a time in the history of the market when taking price into consideration didn't work?" And then, "Well, no, we don't have that. But we've got 5,000 studies showing that the short-term timing doesn't work." Well, you could create 100,000 studies showing short-term timing doesn't work if that makes you happy. It's not going to change the fact that long-term timing has always worked. and that it's not even possible for the rational human mind to imagine a scenario in which long-term timing wouldn't work. Long-term timing is taking price into consideration. How could taking price into consideration when buying something not be a good idea? It's I maintain that it's insane. That to believe passive investing could ever work in the real world, I say is insane. I do not say that people who believe it are insane. They're very smart, good people, but they believe an insane idea. They have developed an allegiance to an insane idea. Well, Frank is he's a skeptic, but he's a fair-minded skeptic, I think. And Frank said, well, okay, you're saying short-term timing doesn't work, long-term timing does. How does the market know, Rob? How's the market know when we switch from short-term to long-term? And I think that's a great question. And so I've given some answers. And I think those answers are partially correct, but I sort of feel about it the way you do when, you know, I don't know, you're watching a detective story and, you know, the person who Columbo is zeroing in on, he has too many stories, you know, too much evidence that he was not at the scene of the crime. And you start to think, you know, the lady doth protest too much here. If your explanation goes on too long, you start to wonder, you know, is it really? If you have 10 explanations, one explanation is sometimes better than 10, because 10, you start to wonder, you know, why do you have so many explanations? So I'd like to have one simple explanation. And I'm going to aim in this podcast to use the concept of deferred market efficiency as my single explanation, which includes within it all the smaller ones, but it's a more simple, more refined concept than the explanations I put forward earlier. Now, this came to mind because there's been a wonderful thread going on at the bogleheads.org board. I don't know the exact title. I've been linking to it at the Today's Passion feature at the site every day for a week now. It's something like, I think the title is something like, It's Not Always Market Timing. I think that's the title. And the guy who put it forward was basically arguing, well, you know, to change your allocation isn't necessarily market timing. Maybe you're just taking price into consideration, which that's one way of pushing the valuation-informed indexing idea. People do it because they don't want to say that market timing works. There's become a social stigma attached to pointing out that market timing always works. And so people try to avoid the social stigma by saying, well, if you change your allocation because of price considerations, that's not really timing. Well, it's semantics. And I don't care how you say it, really, but my usual approach is to take it head on and just say, of course it's timing. Of course it's timing. If you go with an 80% stock allocation when stocks are priced reasonably and you drop to 20% when they're at insanely overvalued prices, you're timing the market. But, you know, good for you. That's what you should be doing. So let's stop apologizing. I don't think rational investors have to stop apologizing. We are so timid and apologetic. But, of course, this is because of the social stigma. And the social stigma is there because the passive investors are so defensive. They're so unsure of themselves. This is the whole problem. All this stuff is emotional, none of it intellectual. Anyway, I think we need to stop apologizing for ourselves. But it was a wonderful thread. And there's a fellow over at Boglehead, CJ King. And he understands valuation-informed indexing better than any. I sometimes think he understands it better than me. He's killer. And he's not banned. I want to point out, and you know, I often say they ban honest posting on valuations of bogleheads, and they do, but they haven't banned CJ King. And a lot of times these people pull punches, so they won't get banned. I would not say that CJ King pulls punches. He says it straight out. He's polite, as I always was, but he's polite, he's friendly, he's warm, but he's honest. He says it, what needs to be said. He really doesn't pull punches. And I applaud him for his wonderful insights, and I applaud the owners of that board for you know, quote-unquote, tolerating him. He's trying to help, but they haven't banned him. And, you know, I think how wonderful that thread would be if all the people that had been banned could participate. John D. Craig and John Walter Russell and Rob Bennett and Mike Rolepsis and retired at 48 and, you know, on and on and on. What a wonderful, wonderful thread that would be. But they haven't banned CJ King. They haven't threatened to ban him, really. They you know, occasionally somebody puts up something a little rude, but nothing over the line. And so that's great, and they should be applauded for that. So CJ King gave an answer to the question of how does the market know when we switched from the short term, where timing doesn't work, to the long term, where it always works. And here's the quote, and I use this as my today's passion link today. Quote, the collective price of companies, stock market capitalization, cannot stay indefinitely far above or far below the cost of creating those companies from scratch. If below, companies looking to expand or cut cost by merging will buy capacity on the stock market, driving up prices. If below, companies will create capacity from scratch, which competes with existing capacity, driving down prices. Now, I had read that explanation, not in those words, but I had heard of that explanation at an earlier time. I believe, my recollection is it's from Andrew Smithers, who's the author of Valuing Wall Street. But I have heard that explanation of how we go from the short term to the long term. And that, I think that's a, I mean, the wording there's a little bit complicated, so I don't know if you picked it up by me reading it. Hopefully when I explain it, you'll pick it up. But the explanation, I think, is right on. And as I say, it incorporates within it a lot of other explanations, some of which I've put on at earlier times and some of which probably haven't occurred to me. There's all sorts of things going on. But that explanation says it pretty well. What he's saying is, in January of 2000, the height of the bubble, the stock market was valued at 3 times fair value. And I'm always saying, you know, if you're a passive investor and you're just a middle class person and you're putting money into stocks every week or every 2 weeks when you get your paycheck, every $1,000 that you put into stocks, you obtained in return $350 worth of stocks and $650 worth of cotton candy nothingness. You were destroying your life savings by investing passively. Destroying your life savings, destroying your chances of achieving a safe retirement in a reasonable amount of time. Destroying wealth for no reason whatsoever. With the only possible reason is it benefited the stock selling industry, but even that, I think, is in a short-term sense, it benefited the stock selling industry, but not in a long-term sense. Because when the middle class destroys as much wealth as we did in the passive investing era, it can throw the entire economy into a depression, which we may yet see. And in that event, you know, the stock selling industry is going to go down too with all the rest of us. So I don't think it benefits anyone. Passive investing is just, in my mind, it's just evil. I wrote a post, I don't remember exactly where this was the other day. It was at the blog. There was a fellow, Larry Weber, asking some good questions. And I wrote a response where I said, I feel about passive investing the way I feel about cancer and illiteracy and racism. I sometimes think people don't take me serious, you know? And so you just got to get it out there. You know, I don't want to compromise. I don't want to say, oh, passive investing sort of kind of good, but no, it's pure undiluted evil. It's ignorance. Doesn't mean the people who believe it are ignorant. Doesn't mean the people who believe it are evil. I don't think that. I think a lot of them are great people. They're my heroes, a lot of them. John Bogle's a hero of mine. But the idea that valuations don't affect long-term returns is dangerous. Dangerous stuff. So, the question, you know, so this idea has taken hold that you don't need to change your stock allocation in response to price changes, in response to valuation changes. The timing doesn't work. This is sums it all up when they say timing doesn't work. But timing means paying attention to price. So what they're saying is paying attention to price doesn't work. It's an insane idea. And I think that all of the emotion that we see in investing is rooted in that, in the belief, in an attempted belief in that idea. I don't believe any rational person can ever really believe in it. We can never have confidence in our investing strategies as long as passive investing is being heavily promoted. It's always going to undermine your confidence. Because if you believe in it, you're believing in something insane and you can't have confidence. And if you don't believe in it, it still chips away at your confidence because they're reporting it on the news every day. And it's making you feel funny. It's making you feel anxious that maybe all these quote-unquote experts know more than you do. So we've got to get to the root. We've got to get to this passive investing problem. And that means getting to the question of, does timing work or doesn't it? The historical data says that short-term timing never works, and the same historical data says that long-term timing always works. And this came up, you know, they were asking CJ King on that thread, well, oh, you know, he was pointing out that the data says that, you know, long-term timing always works, and they said, oh, but there's only 139 years of data, that's not enough. He says, well, if that's not enough, how can you believe in that short-term timing doesn't work? It's the same data saying both things. But they'll quote the data when they say short-term timing doesn't work. But then when the same data shows long-term timing always works, they say, oh, not enough data, not enough data. I mean, it's crazy stuff, crazy stuff. So we need a good answer to Frank's question. How does this market know that we've got, you know, how does the market know that we've gone from the short-term where timing doesn't work to the long-term where it does? Well, that answer basically told us that what happens is in the short term, stock investing is just, it's just totally emotional. I don't know if it's 100%, but emotion dominates. And so emotionally, the idea of pushing stock prices up is just, it's just a grand slam. Just think of the possibilities. If, we could set stock prices wherever we please. We have the power. So we could say, hey, we're all sort of behind on our retirement. You know, we've been trying to save, but not doing a very good job. And, you know, we're all getting a little worried. Why don't we, over the next year, double the price of the S&P? That way we'll all have more money. And, some of us will, you know, shoot past our goal. Others at least will make progress, right? But it benefits us all. So let's all agree to pump up the price of stocks 100% over the next year. And we do that. And not a thing to stop us. If we choose to do that, that's what happened in the 90s. So it's a huge emotional winner. There's just, you know, the idea of not pumping up. I mean, if you're looking for a puzzle, you should ask, why don't we always pump up the price of stocks? Why don't we double it, triple it, quadruple it, quintuple it? Why do we ever stop? That's really the puzzle. What makes us stop? That's what's being answered in that C.J. King quote. What he's saying is, when you get to where we were in January 2000, where the stock market is priced three times fair value, well, that means individual companies are valued at three times fair value. So company ABC, you know, it has all these assets. It has buildings, and it has contracts. It has patents. It has machinery, equipment, all this sort of thing. You know, goodwill with customers, whatever it happens to be. All these things. And you're trying to compete with them. You know, you're a competitor. Or let's say Google. You know, Google's buying up a lot of companies. They go around and they buy up, you know, innovators on the internet. Because they want to stay in the top dog position. Does Google want to go? Google has enough money. They could just duplicate what these competitors do. They could just go in and say, you know, we're going to hire scientists. We're going to hire programmers. We're going to hire, you know, whatever we need. They could do that. We're going to, you know, acquire patents. Do whatever we need. So that we'll beat you. We'll beat you. We're better capitalized. We'll beat you. But If the company is valued at 3 times fair value, well, that's what they're going to do. They're just going to create a competitor, and the competitor is going to do all the same things, but because the original company is valued at 3 times fair value, the competitor's going to be 1/3 of that, and it's going to be making as much profits. Well, that's going to drive the original company out of business. Or what it's really going to do is it's going to lower the stock price. In other words, the stockholders are going to say, why should I put my money in ABC Company when this new company that Google formed has all the same patents, all the same employee force, just as many employees, but I can buy the stock for 1/3. But their earnings are the same. I can get that earnings stream for 1/3. Why not? That drives the price of the ABC company down. That's why we can't double, triple, quadruple, quintuple stock prices. We can vote ourselves raises in the short term. Not a thing to stop us. But there's a limit. Because when you get to 3 times fair value, the overvaluation is so great that people step in and stop it. And that's, of course, the efficient market theory. Essentially, that's the whole idea. That's where passive investing comes from. The idea that people do that the market is fundamentally rational. And it is. But notice, Google can't create that company in a day. You see, the academics, when they're writing something on a blackboard, all they have to do is have this idea enter their head and they write it down. You know, Google could create a company DEF and it would drive the price of company ABC down and therefore the market's efficient. Well, it's true. Theoretically, it's true. But in the practical, real world, there's a lot of steps. You got to get licenses. You got to find a place to set your building and, you know, put the building up, and you got to find employees. You got to interview people. You got to, you know, come up with these patents. You got to find scientists and you got to find managers, and it doesn't happen overnight. It doesn't happen in 24 hours. It can take years to do such a thing. And then you've got to get the investing public to recognize, excuse me, to recognize what you've done. You got to send out press releases. You got to do interviews. You got to be tested in the marketplace. You got to succeed. This can take 3 years, 5 years, 10 years. It takes years. So there is a delay. There is an efficient market. Virginia, yes. Virginia, there is an efficient market. But no, it's not instantaneous like the ivory tower eggheads like to tell us. Like Eugene Fama likes to tell us. It's not instantly efficient. It becomes efficient. There's a deferred market efficiency. It can take 5 years. It can take 10 years. Now, I think this is what's going on. I think this is the reality of stock investing. The people who came up with the efficient market theory, you know, did a great deal of good. They generated hundreds of insights through their work, and we should be grateful to them. But they are ivory tower eggheads. There's no getting around it, and they're stubborn as the day is long, and they don't want to admit they got some stuff wrong. And what they got wrong is that the market is not efficient in 24 hours. The market's efficient in 5 years or 10 years or sometimes 30 years. So what we've got is a situation where passive investing is a model where what passive investing is they took these ivory tower egghead ideas and translated them into investing advice. And they got right about what you should do in the short term. In the short term, they say, you know, don't try to time the market in the short term. And that's right. Not because they got it for the wrong reason. But they got the right result. The market, they say don't do it because the market's efficient. The thing is, don't do it because the market's emotional. But the advice is right. Don't try to engage in short-term timing. And in terms of what happens 30 years out, they also got it right. That's what gives a lot of their ideas plausibility. Because you go 30 years out, and there are differences, you know, based on valuation of 30 years out, but they're not that great. 30 years out, the advice from the passive investors is good enough. It's close enough. But they got all the rest wrong. They got wrong about what you should do in 5 years and what you should do in 10 years, what you should do in 15 years, what you should do in 20 years. All that's wrong. And that just happens to be the thing that matters most. Because most investors, most middle-class people are perfectly happy not to get great returns in 6 months. There are some people, you know, day traders, they want to get it in 24 hours. But most of us are saving for our retirement. And we're not trying to beat the market, just trying to do okay. So, you know, the short term really doesn't matter to us that much. We're looking to retirement, might be 10 years out, 20 years out, whatever. That's what we're worried about. But most of us can't possibly wait 30 years to get a good stock return because we're middle class. We don't have a lot of extra assets. And when we lose two-thirds of our assets because we were investing in this lame-brained, upside-down approach, it literally destroys our lives. It means we're afraid. We can't spend. We can't go on vacations. We can't buy cars. The economy collapses. We're afraid to send our sons and daughters to college because we don't know if we can afford to or not. We have no idea how much wealth we have. Because a lot of our wealth is tied up in the market. And you can go through a 10-year time period where the market values your assets at one half of what they're really worth. So, you know, we were at 3 times fair value in January 2000. In the next few years, we're likely to go to one half fair value. That's a difference of 600%. So, you know, there are going to be people 3-4 years from now looking at their portfolio. And you know, the real value of the portfolio, let's just say, to pick a number, is $100,000. And it will be valued at $50,000. And back in January 2000, it was valued at $300,000. So they went from $300,000 down to $50,000 in real terms. Inflation was, of course, taking place over this time. So in dollars, that's not what it's going to say. But in real terms, they went from $300,000 to $50,000. How can you sanely plan your financial affairs if you're not making an adjustment for valuations? And your life savings has gone from $300,000 to $50,000. That's the effect of believing in passive investing. Whereas if you believe in rational, you adjusted the $300,000 down. You knew from the first day it wasn't worth $300,000, so you adjusted it to $100,000. And now when it's nominally $50,000, you adjust it up to $100,000. So you have stability. And with stability, you can engage in effective financial planning. So the passives get everything right except what matters. They get the short term right. They get the very distant long term right. They get the long term wrong, and that's what middle class people care about. The time period from 5 years to 25 years. That's what we care about, and that the passives get, you know, 100% wrong. So, deferred market efficiency, what it is, what it signifies. Well, I think deferred market efficiency is the answer to our problems. We need to somehow challenge these ivory tower eggheads and get them to acknowledge that yes, they made a big contribution, but no, they didn't get it all right in the first draft. And then we need to go about getting it right. And getting it right means, see, what I'm coming to believe more and more, and I've sort of believed this all along, but it's just the message keeps getting confirmed. Everybody thinks stock investing is complicated and scary and risky and hard to understand. And I am coming to believe it's not so. Stock investing is pretty darn simple. I'm sometimes afraid to say it, but it's so simple. If just we didn't have passive investing messing it up. I did a podcast not too long ago, another one, is sort of on the same theme, that was called I was wrong. There is no equity risk premium. I don't, the passives say that the reason why we get 6.5 real in stocks is there's some kind of market force and stocks are more risky and we're being compensated for risk. And I think that's baloney. We're not being compensated for risk. The reason stocks pay 6.5 is that's, I believe, this is just one guy on the internet, you know, that's all. No, I never managed any big fund, never went to investing school. Please keep that in mind. I believe we get paid 6.5 real because that's how much US productivity generates. That's the return, you know, financed by US productivity throughout history. It's likely to be that in the future, somewhere around there. Could be a little less, could be a little more. It's probably going to be somewhere around 6.5 real. Nothing to do with being compensated for risk. If you want 6.5 real, buy stocks. If you don't, buy something else. But that's what stocks in the US provide. Like it or not, and it's a wonderful return, so you should like it. So how more simple could the story be? Invest in stocks, right? But there's a rub. The rub is, right now, we're telling people that to invest passively, and as long as we're telling, and there's only one problem with stock investing, that's volatility. That's it. It's the only problem. So what we should be trying to do is to eliminate volatility. There's no need for volatility. The passives will tell you that the market discounts future dividend streams. So, as long as the market is properly discounting future dividend streams, the stock price would always stay the same. Not the price, but the valuation level, the P10 level. The P10 level, if we were rational, would always be somewhere around 14, 15. Always. There's never any need for any variation. There's going to be recessions that, of course, bring temporary earnings down, but they don't affect the long term. The long term earnings are going to compensate. So the stock price should always be roughly the same. The valuation level should always be roughly the same. The price should always go up about 6.5 real per year. So why doesn't it? All the emotionalism, all the difficulty in understanding stocks comes from that, comes from volatility. What can we do? What we have to do is stop telling people to invest passively. Because if you just tell people that when the valuation level goes up, the long-term value proposition goes down, guess what people will do happily? They'll sell stocks when the valuation level goes up, which will bring the valuation level back down, which eliminates volatility. We'll just always stay at those same P10 levels. And we'll just get that 6.5 and we'll all be happy and live happily evermore. But we can't get there unless we're willing to acknowledge the mistakes of the past. You can't get to point C from point A without passing through point B. And point B are those three magic words, I and was and wrong. So we've got market efficiency, but we don't have it in 24 hours. What we have is deferred market efficiency. And that, you know, there are a lot of implications to that. I mean, one of the things to look at is, you know, what's going on in this buildup stage. In other words, what's happening is there's a say a 10-year period where, you know, prices keep going up. And people will ask this all the time. Well, Rob, you say you can predict stock prices. Why can't you can predict them in the long term? Why can't you predict them in the short term? You can't predict them in the short term because the rational forces don't apply. It takes it. There's this. I don't know. I think of it as friction. In other words, you have to file for these companies to come in. You have to do all these things. You have to file for licenses and get this and get that and hire the employees. And it just takes time. And in the short term, you've got that huge emotional pull saying bid prices up as high as you can. And there's no way any human being can calculate to the day when the long-term rationality is going to come to dominate over the short-term emotion. No one can figure that out, I don't believe. So what happens is there's always, of course, some people who are rational. Even in the most irrational market we've ever seen, there have always been rational investors. And so what we do is the irrational investors are scared to death. The passives are scared to death that somebody's going to tell the reality. Somebody's going to squeal, and the whole deck, you know, the whole house of cards is going to collapse. And so we develop these social stigmas that prevent people from telling the true story. And this is what passive investing is. Passive investing is a huge social taboo. It's a prop. And so what happens is, you know, you tell people that the safe withdrawal rate's wrong. You tell people their retirement numbers are wrong. And they say, oh, no, can't be. Passive investing says it's right. In other words, they cite the experts as the authority, but the experts are the very people that caused the insane bull market in the first place with their goofy theories. It's all circular. If you're going to believe in passive investing, then you've got to believe in phony retirement numbers. Because the whole point of passive investing is to encourage people to invest recklessly. Not deliberately so, I don't say. But that's the driving force. The driving force is to rationalize bad decisions. Passive investing is an investing model that specializes in rationalizing poor investing decisions. Decisions that will destroy long-term wealth. So referring to passive investing as your excuse for using bad retirement numbers is just it's just circular. Passive investing is part of the problem. It's part of the friction. It's part of the thing that holds off rationality for years. But it always gets defeated. The social taboo always gets defeated. Rationality always outs in the end. It always has, and it always must, because if it doesn't out, the market would collapse, the economic system would collapse. That's what we're facing today. We're saying, do we want to correct this or do we want the whole thing to collapse? And what the market is trying to scare us. You know, it's not an accident we're scared. The market's trying to scare us because the market wants to survive. The market is us, remember. All it is reflecting us back at ourselves. The market wants to survive. We want to survive. If we didn't want to survive, we wouldn't have had this crash. The crash is a sign that we want to live. And living means acknowledging the lies that we've told ourselves for 30 years. And rebuilding. Rebuilding from the financial devastation we caused with those lies. Now, what was I going to say here? Let me try to pull this together. Oh, I wanted to say, I deliberately used in the title deferred market efficiency. You know, I thought of different ways of saying it. I thought of saying delayed market efficiency. I chose the word deferred because of the parallel with the concept you always hear in the saving area, which is deferred gratification. Now, I'm not really a big fan of a focus on deferred gratification. The last podcast I did, number 173, was entitled, It's Spending That Makes You Rich. So I believe the way people should be deciding how much to spend is to compare value propositions of spending versus saving. But what I said is that spending and saving are not opposites. Saving is essentially spending plus. It's a superpowered form of spending. And what makes it superpowered is this deferral element. What you're doing is you're taking money that's passing through your hands and you're saying, I want to make that money more powerful. Money enhances my enjoyment of life. I want to enhance my enjoyment of life more than other people do. So I'm going to defer a little bit. And this wonderful money stuff will become empowered and my life will be better than it would be if I had spent. And you don't always do that, but you do that in circumstances where saving offers the better long-term value proposition than spending. Well, the same, you know, there's a parallel here on the investing side. What the passive investors are doing is they're saying, let's assume, there's no evidence of this, but let's assume that the market is efficient instantly. Now, it's sort of like a spender saying, let's assume that the best thing to do with your money is to spend it all. There's no evidence that's true. Savers do wonderful things with their lives that they couldn't do if they spent all their money. if they lived mouth to hand, you know, hand to mouth, if they just spent everything as soon as they got it. But the passive, say, let's just assume that. Assume that's the best. Let's assume that there should be no, that there's no deferral in market efficiency, that it happens instantly. And that assumption is death. Because just at, you know, if you look at a really bad case of spendthrift, you know, a spendthrift that's a really bad case, what you'll see is you'll say to them, look, you know, you're ruining your life. You buy these clothes and you put them in a closet and you never even take the tags off of them. You know, you never wear them. And then you complain you don't have money to go on a nice vacation, or you don't have money to buy a nice house, but you've got all these things you never even wear. You know, you're hurting yourself. What will they do? They will go into rationalization mode. They bought into the idea somehow emotionally. There is no rational justification for such behavior. If the clothes hang in your closet and you don't take the tags off, and a lot of people do this, you know, I know people, they have what do you call it? Storage units. They have so much junk that they buy storage units and store it there, and they pay for these storage units. It's like they pay rent. But they don't live there. Their stuff lives there. They never see the stuff. They never touch the stuff. The stuff never does anything good for them. But they pay to keep it. There's not room in their house for the stuff. They've got big houses, but they can't fit all the stuff in. There's no rational justification for some of these things. But there's an emotional justification. The emotional justification is if you were to acknowledge that it was just junk that was weighing you down rather than enhancing your enjoyment of life, you'd have to admit that you were wrong to buy all that junk. And the human mind doesn't want to do it. Well, the same thing's true with the passive investors. If they were to admit that they could retire years sooner, if they were willing to invest rationally, if they were willing to take price into consideration, they'd have to admit having made a mistake. They'd have to admit having done great damage to their hopes of achieving financial freedom by this buying into this passive investing junk. They'd have to acknowledge that efficiency is deferred. Everything that happens in life is an instant. Some things can be true, you know, and I say spending is good. I don't say spending is bad. I say spending makes you rich. But instant spending isn't always good. Sometimes deferred gratification makes more sense. Same thing with investing. I mean, more or less, not exactly the same, but there's similarities. Efficiency is good and efficiency is real, but efficiency isn't necessarily instant. Sometimes there's deferred efficiency. Once you let that in, a whole world of exciting investing possibilities open up to you. If you can just let that in, that efficiency is not necessarily instant. It can be deferred. It often is deferred. Now, a really interesting angle on this is the question of the deferral, the length of the deferral. The length is going to vary. You know, as I say, if Google's going to set up this company, whatever, it's going to take, you know, X amount of time. But, you know, ordinarily what we see when we look at the data is, the historical data, is that it takes 10 years for this stuff to work its way through. I mean, if you're going to pick a general rule, of course, sometimes, you know, you can invest rationally and get a payoff the next day. You know, if you invest it rationally, if you took your money out of stocks last August because you wanted to invest rationally, you got a payoff in September. It was great. But you can't count on that. Could take 5 years, could take 10 years. Sometimes it can take a little more than 10 years. But I think an interesting way to think about it is this. To the market, which is this sort of big thing, I don't think that's a big deal. You know, 10 years is, see, what we're talking about, all we're talking about is, you know, companies having to get licenses and hire employees and all this sort of thing. This is just normal life. There's nothing, you know, the explanation I'm giving for why the efficient market is deferred, I'm not giving any grand explanation. I'm saying, You know, it's the most obvious common sense thing there could be. You have to file licenses. You have to get patents, you know. You have to put out PR releases, you know. These things don't happen overnight. Could anything be more basic and obvious? But to the market, the fact that it takes 5 years for efficiency to kick in or 10 years, it's really nothing. In the grand scheme of things, that 10 years, you know, it's not a big deal. The markets have been around in one form or another for hundreds of years or maybe thousands of years. So it's not a big deal. It's sort of like, it's just this little nothing. But to the individual, that 10 years, that's the difference between whether your financial planning efforts of a lifetime work or don't work. That's how significant it is to the individual. I love to give the example of what happened to people who believed in passive investing in January of 2000. January of 2000, you had two choices to take: the passive emotional route or the logical, rational route. And boy, was there ever a distinction. And there were people at this time writing in letters to, you know, Money Magazine and all these other places saying, what should I do? And so-called experts were telling them, you should put most of your money in stocks. Let's compare. I have a calculator at my website, the Stock Return Predictor, that tells you the most likely 10-year return on stocks, you know, based on a regression analysis of the historical stock return data in January 2000. The most likely 10-year return, not the worst case, the most likely return was a negative 1% real, annualized. That means every year for 10 years, you were going to lose 1% of your portfolio on average. Not every year, of course. Some years be more and some years less. But you were likely to average a 1% loss per year for 10 years running. So, if you started out with $1 million, say that you were 10 years from retirement, you know, and you need $1 million to retire, and you're pretty close to your goal. You had $1 million. You're going to lose 1% a year. Nah, I guess that's boy. Now I put myself in a fix here. I'm going to have to do math. If like, what is 1%? I think is 10. Is it 10,000 a year? 1% of a million. I think it's 10. I think it's 10,000 a year. Yeah, because the 4% rule would be living on 40,000 a year. So 1% would mean 10,000 a year. So you're going to lose, if you had $1 million at 55. You'd saved up $1 million over, you know, a lifetime. It's a lifetime work to save $1 million. You started when you were 25. 30 years work generated that million. Now you're going to lose 10,000 a year for 10 years running. But the alternative was to invest in Treasury inflation-protected securities, which were paying 4% real per year, guaranteed by the U.S. government. No risk whatsoever. Zero risk asset class. That would have been a gain of $40,000 a year. So the differential each year was $50,000. Every year for 10 years, you lost $10,000 when you could have been making $40,000. Differential, $50,000 a year for 10 years running. This isn't a one-time thing. 10 years. $50,000 loss times 10 is $500,000. $500,000. That's the cost of investing passively for that individual. $500,000 of wealth. And people have a hard time understanding why we're suffering an economic crisis today. We had Money Magazine telling people to take the course of action that would cause them to lose $500,000 in 10 years. Millions of people believe this. One of the things I put on my list I want to do is a podcast exploring how much we lost, you know, in different circumstances. Because the circumstance I'm drawing obviously isn't the only one that applies. Not everybody had $1 million, and if you had less, you lost less. But we all lost a lot. And of course, we ultimately may lose it all because we lost so much that it may be our economy is not going to recover. And if the economy doesn't recover and we go into a depression, we may lose it all. All of us may lose it all. So, but one individual in the scenario I described would have lost $500,000. So the point here is, the fact that there's 10 years of deferral in terms of this huge entity called the market, which is all of us combined, that's sort of it's a little bump in the road. The 10 years, it doesn't really matter. It's nothingness. It's just, you got to, in order to get efficient, there are forms that have to be filled out. It's paperwork, essentially, is what it comes to. So the academics just brush it off. To the academics, it's just, it's a rounding error. All the calculations are right. I'm not going to win a Nobel Prize pointing out that there's a little, forms that have to be filled out. That's not Nobel Prize material. So they don't even mention it. They don't care. But in the real world, it's not like on the chalkboards. In the real world, you've got to hire employees to make the market efficient. In the real world, you got to fill out forms. In the real world, you got to send out PR releases. In the real world, investors don't flock to you until you prove what you can do. In the real world, it can take 10 years to get market prices back to sanity. So for the real world investor, believing in passive investing for 10 years can come with a price tag of $500,000 attached. So the point is, when you're looking at this from a global perspective, the friction, the delay, the deferral before the efficient market takes is a small little bump in the road. Hardly worth drawing attention to if you're trying to win a Nobel Prize or get peer-reviewed research approved. But to the individual investor, it's a lifetime of savings. It's $500,000. To a middle-class person, that's real money. This is the problem. The problem we have, the subtitle of my book, I sense these things often before I can verbalize them. I think it's a skill I have. I mean, I don't mean to brag, but I think one of the skills I have, there are not that many, frankly, but there are one or two. And I think one is that I can sort of sense things that are out there and I can't articulate them. But when I was, I spent a long time writing a subtitle for this book, a long time. I must have tried out at least 500 of them before I was happy with one. And the one that I believe I'm going to go with, no final decisions until there's printing, but the one I believe I'm going to go with is how to get what works on paper to work in real life. Well, I've just described the biggest reason why passive investing works on paper and not in real life. Because on paper, the fact that it takes 10 years for the efficient market to click, on paper, it's a footnote, not a biggie. Dealing with this grand economy of trillions of dollars, and what's 10 years? A little friction, But to the individual investor, and what passive investing is all about, is taking these academic constructs and trying to apply them in the real world for people, middle-class people, to plan their retirements, essentially. And when you apply it to the middle-class person, you're looking at a loss of $500,000. That little bump in the road is a life-threatening event. And we need to start, focusing in on the bump in the road, not just saying, oh, well. I remember Bill Bernstein one time on a discussion board, somebody pointed out the efficient market theory is wrong, which means the whole model he uses to write all his books about investing is wrong, which essentially means everything he says is wrong. And Bill's response was, oh, well, it's only the model. Only the model's wrong. Only the model. If the model's wrong, it's all wrong. The model is the foundation. He gets his, he of course gets the calculations right. The problem is if the model's wrong, all the numbers you're using in the calculations are wrong. So you're doing perfect calculations of nonsense. You can't get the model wrong. You got to get the model right. And that's what all the work at passionsaving.com is about. It's about going back to first principles and trying to get the market right. The way to say it is, yes, markets are efficient. And again, we should be thankful to the people that discovered this, because rational investing wouldn't exist without passive investing. It's a reaction to passive investing. It's a rejection of it. But without the findings of the passive investors, we wouldn't be here. We'd be in the dark. Markets are efficient, but only reluctantly so. Markets are not instantly efficient. Markets are driven to efficiency, kicking and screaming. They don't want to be efficient, because you see, again, I want to say it. I feel like I can't say it enough times. The market is us. So when we say markets are efficient, what we're saying is we are efficient. That's what we're saying. And what the proper way to say it would be to say we are rational. This word efficient, again, it's gobbledygook. It's academic speak. They want to impress us, and they use terms that we can't quite understand because it makes them seem smarter. If we don't understand them, they must be smart. I think what makes you smart is when you speak clearly. And the clear way of saying it would be to say the market is rational. That's what they mean to say. What they're saying is the market sets the price properly, which means the market is rational. And the market is us. Are we rational? Are we rational? Are your friends rational? Do you have any friends who drink too much? If you do, can't say your friends are rational, can you? You have any friends who speed? If you do, your friends aren't rational, are they? Have any friends who cheat on their spouses, destroy their families? If you do, your friends aren't rational. Are there insights that can be developed by assuming we're rational? Sometimes. But if you start taking those assumptions too seriously, you're going to get yourself in a whole heap of trouble. And if a friend comes to you in tears because they've their lives is falling apart around them, and you say, you must have been irrational. You must have made mistakes. You shouldn't have married. Your spouse is cheating on them, so they come to you in tears, and you say, "Oh, what was your mistake? If you were rational, you would have seen what he was, and you would have never devoted 20 years of your life to him. You're not rational. You're worthless. Don't bother me with your tears." That's the passive investing mindset. Every violation of rationality is dismissed. What the passive investors really dismiss is humanity. Human life is a combination of the rational and the irrational, a combination of the emotional and the rational. That's what human life is. That's what humans are. We're, a rational animal. We have rationality. We're capable of it. But the tragedy of human life is we can't always exercise it. It's sometimes beyond us. That's where compassion comes in. That's where understanding comes in. That's where love comes in. That's what makes life worth living, that we recognize that we're not robots with legs. We are people. We're humans. And it's humans who invest. And if the passives can't acknowledge that, then the passives have to go back to square one and start over. What I'm saying here, all of rational investing, all that you hear on these podcasts is a combination of numbers, the hard stuff, the quantifiable, the rational, and the human influence on those numbers, the emotional, the irrational. And we work it together, because that's what the market is. The market is people, and the market is both. So the market always has this drive to rationality, to efficiency. Always it's there. That's real. That's important. That's real. But the market also always has a drive to irrationality. We always have that drive within us that says, hey, let's vote ourselves a raise. Let's 6.5 is nice, but why not 15? Why not 20? Why not 25? Do I hear 30? That's what we saw in the late 1990s. And responsible people, responsible experts, would have been standing up and calling us out on the nonsense. John Bogle should have been standing in front of a room saying, no more. This is intolerable. We are destroying our economic and political system. I will not be part of it. But of course, John Bogle has his own emotions to deal with, and his emotion said, you know, I've built this, and I don't want to think that it's flawed. We've all got emotions. We all better recognize it. What it comes to is, as I said, investing can be so simple. It can be just a matter of cashing the checks for 6.5 every year. But it can only be made that simple if we develop self-awareness. That's what rational investing is. Rational investing is self-aware investing. That's actually an alternate title for it. I mean, I've used rational investing for so long now, I'll probably stick with it, but it could be called self-aware investing. It's about lifting the fog, lifting the veil, and seeing ourselves for what we are. Some people would say it's not a flattering picture. Some people would say, oh, you know, we destroyed ourselves in the 90s. Who wants to hear that? Shut up, Rob. I don't want to hear it. It's obnoxious. It's a troll. Spammy. Well, maybe. It's not flattering in a sense that we've destroyed ourselves this way. It's not in a sense it's not flattering. But I don't know. God put us here for a reason. God knows what we are. God made us what we are. And I think God wants us to sort through it and make the best of it. And God sees a beauty in the way we struggle to correct these flaws and these errors and these mistakes, I believe. So when I talk about the great debate, I always say, yes, there's this dark side to it where we've seen the worst of human nature. And of course, whenever I talk about the great debate, it's just a way of portraying what happens out in the market. A community discussion board is a market of its own. It's a little market. It's a testing ground for how investing works in the real world. So if you see that ugliness on a discussion board, then you see it in the real market. You see it, you know, when people try to get papers approved for peer